Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
My guest is John Cozy. Regular listeners know John. He's a retired philosophy and logic professor. He's now writing on social, political, and economic issues. And that's how I first came across John. I read one of his articles, and I thought it was terrific. Now I read all of them, and when I read the first one, I said, I've got to get John on the program. And my good fortune and listeners' good fortune that we're able to get him on often, and we got him back again today. John does a lot of writing. He taught for many years before he did that. And he's been, am I saying something wrong?
No, I'm just got a little cough here.
Oh, I have a lot of frogs that I need to get rid of, John. And at my age, a lot of cobwebs, too. But I just want to give listeners your website, which is www.jcozy.com. And John's got a new article that he calls The Nefarious Nine and the First Amendment. Gee, I wish we'd send those Nefarious Nine over to Libya and put them on the front lines. Right in front of those rebels, John. We want to talk about that nefarious group. I certainly don't call them a legitimate judicial system, especially who they represent. They don't represent us at all, and they come up with these rulings that absolutely are indeed nefarious. You want to start on those other minor things going on around the world?
Oh, sure. Let's just start about those trivial little things like earthquakes and tsunamis.
And nuclear disasters. The nuclear disaster alone, John, a lot of it is being covered up. Yesterday, I wrote my eighth article on Japan, all on the earthquake. I'm not talking about, no, I'm sorry, all on the nuclear disaster. I'm not talking about the earthquake and tsunami that were bad enough, obviously. I think they're covering up the number of people killed. I think it's going to be double or triple the number, at least, from those two events. I mean, it was a monster earthquake and a monster tsunami. The pictures were horrific. And then you get this nuclear situation, a massive cover-up going on about it. And I really think, I wrote one article, I quoted Helen Caldicott, who's a very distinguished nuclear expert, has been for decades, and I exchanged emails with her and spoke to her on the phone, and I've read all her books except one. And I picked up an interview she gave with somebody in print, and somebody asked her if she thought it would be worse than Chernobyl. And she said, I think the question was, will it be 30 times worse than Chernobyl? And she said, 30 times, maybe more than 30 times, something like that. So I wrote an article that I titled Multiples Worse Than Chernobyl. Well, who knows? It's still unfolding now. But I honestly believe this will turn out to be by far the worst environmental calamity ever, ever. I mean, nothing approaching this before it's over, but massive cover-up is concealing just what's going on. Your thoughts on it, John?
You know, I don't have any doubt that there's been a cover-up and that a cover-up will continue and that it's, as you say, the most massive calamity environmental calamity that the human beings have faced. But the real cover-up is the one that bothers me, and I don't even think it's conscious in most people's minds. And that is, we've adopted this stupid notion that I call the religion of technology. And we continue to believe, in spite of all that happens over and over and over and over again, that technology will save us from our fate, when, in fact, technology determines our fate. And it is not, the determination is not in the right direction. So, you know, that's the real thing. And I don't even, you know, when nuclear experts and scientists and all these people come on and talk about, you know, how bad this is going to be, and they're always talking about, you know, what's going to happen to nuclear energy, and they don't really get the point. You just tell them, yeah, guys, but you are the cause of it. You know, quit talking about how bad it is. Quit talking, you know, and what's going to happen. What needs to happen is to get rid of it. And until people like nuclear scientists and experts and all these people face that fact, the human race is going to be continually convulsed by these kinds of events.
John,
and it doesn't matter, you know, whether it's in the Gulf of Mexico, or off the shores of Alaska, or in Chernobyl, or in Japan, or anywhere else. Technology leads to catastrophe, because we cannot ever build it so that it doesn't fail.
John, I absolutely agree with you. And the most esteemed nuclear experts who I respect say exactly the same thing. A nuclear energy is really a technology from hell. As you say, I mean, no technology is perfect, and all machines break down. They wear out just like the human machine, and you have a problem with a nuclear reactor, a nuclear plant, especially they get old, and you've got giant corporations that are only concerned about their bottom line, so they look to save money by cutting costs, and cutting costs might be maybe a few fewer employees, and extending maintenance cycles and letting things run longer than they should. This company in Japan, John, Tokyo Electric, TEPCO, it has an absolutely horrific record of safety violations and all kinds of abuses, and they literally every single day that they've been operating apparently been playing nuclear roulette. A nuclear roulette is a game you can't win. And finally, it blew up on them this time. And they literally may have caused a problem that is not containable. I mean, if this thing is really out of control, and the radiation levels that we know about, I worry most about what we don't know about. And I worry at least as much about what maybe they don't even know, because they can't get to all the things they need to get to inside the plant, because the radiation levels are so high. I can't imagine why anybody's going in there. They're committing suicide. All those people are going to die, and plus all the people around their plant within so many miles. But we may have really unleashed a real life Andromeda strain, and there may be no going back from this. And how many people will die potentially from this? It'll be years before we know. But we'll never know.
The radioactive iodine or whatever it is that's getting into the sea and getting into the fish and the aquatic mammals and getting into the ground, that's going to get into plants that animals are going to eat, and nobody knows. I mean, That is the biggest scam that science has pulled on the human race. You know, science is a wonderful thing if you're searching for knowledge, but if you ever get to the point where you think you've found certainty in science, then you're a damned liar. You know, and that's all there is to that.
Well, again, I absolutely agree, John. I will say this, and I had it in a couple of my articles. The official death toll from Chernobyl, you know, by the authorities over there, was 4,000 people. Well, many years later, we're talking about 1986, so many years later, there was a detailed scientific study done, and they came up with numbers that were close to 1 million deaths.
One million
deaths from Chernobyl. Now, just imagine how potentially bad this Fukushima disaster is. I mean, Helen Caldicott has said that this thing very likely will affect not only the Pacific Rim in Japan, but the entire northern hemisphere. And how the winds circulate globally, I don't know. She said Australia will be safe from this. Unless the wind suddenly changed direction, but the entire northern hemisphere. And in my last article, I said there have been readings picked up in California, in Hawaii before that, in Alaska, and in Montreal, besides other cities, showing radiation fallout that has to be from Fukushima. I mean, people are going to get cancer from this in America and in Canada.
Well, and it will circulate around the globe from west to east for decades.
That's
and
right.
It'll continue falling, you know, falling to Earth, and how that's going to affect the lives of people, nobody knows.
It won't be good, that's for sure.
No, it will not be good. It's you know.
But John, you're right.
As was a crazy horse said when he led his Braves in the battle of Bull Run or whatever it was. It's a good day to die.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
Well, that hurts. That hurts.
Yeah.
That really hurts. But again, I want to stress the point that you made, and again, the experts say the same thing. There's only one solution. We have to get rid of this monster. We have to close down every nuclear reactor. We have to get rid of nuclear weapons. I don't know what the devil we're going to do with the nuclear waste. There's no possible answer for it. There literally is no possible answer for it, unless they can find a way to shoot it into outer space so it doesn't come back. I don't know if that could ever be possible, but there's no place you can store this stuff. You can put it in any kind of a container you want, anywhere on the planet, and over enough years, something might happen, and those containers might erupt, they might erode, they might do anything. And that stuff is going to come out, and it's going to contaminate the environment, and it's going to spread. And, again, there's no solution. So they created a monster, and they have no solution to the outstanding problem that, you know, the nuclear age dawned during World War II. And to this day, they have no answer to what they're going to do with the waste.
Yep.
Well, of course, the answer is there is no answer.
No, yeah, there is no answer, isn't there? The waste isn't going to be waste anymore. It's going to be what there is.
Well, we're all going to be wasted from this waste.
Yeah.
And one of the other, I mean, there's so many dirty secrets about nuclear power. One of the dirty secrets is it is not clean and green. It is anything but clean and green.
And worse, it's not cheap.
It sure as hell isn't cheap. And the only way any entrepreneur will go into the nuclear power business is if the government pays for the insurance. No insurance company will insure a reactor. No insurance company will assure residents of a locale against a nuclear disaster. And the only way anybody can operate a nuclear power plant is that the government pays for it if there's a disaster. Well, I don't know what the devil the government would pay for. They're not going to pay people if they get sick. And I mean, if one exploded and killed people, and you saw the corpses right then and there, maybe the government would do something. Who knows?
$200 for burial costs.
The way they do in Afghanistan, you know, they murder your husband or your brother or somebody, and they send you a small check with a condolence card. That's the way the system works. And the same.
I was really thinking about Social Security, but that's all right.
Well, it's getting to be social insecurity. they want to take that away. They want to poison us, John, and they want to take away our retirement benefit.
Well, I think that's always been the plan.
Oh, well, it absolutely is the plan. That's a separate topic. I've written about it, and there's no question in my mind. I mean, they want to end Medicare, they want to end Medicaid. I mean, they need money to fight these damn wars, and to bail out bankers in case they ask for more money. But then they say, I've said this on a few interviews. You know, I mean, there's an open checkbook to fight these damn wars, to bail out the bankers. You know, how much you need? A billion? $100 billion? $1 trillion? $5 trillion? Okay, we'll print it up. The Fed has a magic printing press. Bernanke made the statement before he ever became Fed chairman, and I wish I had the quote in front of me. I've used it a couple of times in articles where a speech, maybe around 2002 or so. He was an economic advisor to the Bush administration. I guess he was handpicked to replace Greenspan at that time. But he said something like, well, the Fed has a magic tool or something or other in case the economy gets in trouble. It's a printing press, but it's not literally a printing press. It's a keyboard. You know, you click up any damn amount you want.
Yep.
You want a trillion? Sure. You want a few zeros added to it? Sure. No problem.
I'll add to my previous comment, that too is a result of technology.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, that technology which is going to save us from our fate.
Well, it's a terrible system, John, and based on letting the big corporate predators get bigger and do us more harm, including pollute and steal, and we wage wars for them so they can make more money. Wars are great. Wars are terrific. I mean, the more wars we make, wage, the more weapons we need. And the more things we blow up, the more things we have to rebuild. Oh, the companies love that. I mean, just level a country to dust. Marvelous. We'll go back and rebuild it again. I mean, it's terrific for profits, and that's the way the system runs. And, of course, people get hurt, and the people, I fear for the Libyans right now. The Libyans are really going through hell, and there's no question. We all know, John, and everybody listening to this program knows, that anything coming out of the mouth of a politician is a lie. Doesn't matter whether it's your congressman, whether it's the president, whether it's a Supreme Court justice. You know, I mean, they're as outlandish as all the rest of them. But the idea that this is the Libyan affair, or the Afghan affair, or the Iraq affair, was for anything to do with anything humanitarian, was a bald-faced lie. It was about regime change in every single case, and that's what's going on in Libya right now. And I put out an article today, John, that there is a plan, and it will be implemented if the air attack doesn't work, which is unlikely, and the plan is to invade Libya.
Well, I mean that strikes me not so much as a plan but as a consequence. Once you stick your foot in the water and slip, you're wet.
Oh, you betcha, you betcha.
The idiocy that Americans accept that I shudder at, though. Everybody knows that politicians lie. Well, everybody knows that almost everybody in America lies. I mean, what marketing firm doesn't lie? You know, what commercial firm doesn't lie? What banker doesn't lie? What politician doesn't lie? But Hillary, oh yes, Hillary, she claimed that the international community had sanctioned this episode in Libya. And I said to myself, international community, huh? I think that was called the Security Council of the United Nations, which is made up of less than 5% of the countries in the world. And that less than 5% of the countries in the world turn out to be the international community. I mean, what kind of a lie is that? You know, but people don't break things down that way. I mean, there are about 200 countries in the world, and five permanent members of the Security Council, which really, or who are the ones who really run things, because they bribe the others if they can't get their consent. And that those nine people are so, you know, that comprises the international community. And the international community is now waging this war against Libya. No, it's not the international community. It's the United States, France, and Great Britain. That's all that's waging the war. I mean, well, you know, nobody ever tells the truth. And one of the ways of lying is, of course, to speak in generalities.
Oh, you betcha, John, again. I mean, absolutely. And I'll let you continue. But
Well, I didn't want to continue that point. It's just this point that I was trying to make, that, you know, when a politician wants to tell a lie, he never mentions anything specific. All he does is talk in some generality. You know, the international community, our the coalition. What coalition?
The coalition of the bribed and bullied.
Yeah. And then what? Some Arab country sends a mechanic with a wrench in his back pocket, you know, to help fix a broken down jet or something or other. And now that country is part of a coalition. I mean, this is you know even too bizarre to be laughable. But that's what happens, of course, all the time.
Well, you know, it's even worse in Libya, by the way, and this will be in my article going out tomorrow, another Libya article. But the so-called opposition forces that we're allied with in Libya, I don't know that they're all comprised of these people, but the violent ones, and there's extreme violence going on in these opposition-held areas because of who these people are. These are the same people who went into Iraq after we came in back in 2003, and they were attacking us, and a lot of them were suicide bombers, and they were absolutely against what we were doing in Iraq. So these are the people who we're partnering with now, and I have one short paragraph near the end of my article for tomorrow where I say, I don't say it in these words, but I wonder if this tiger is going to come back and bite us. I mean, these people may want to get rid of Gaddafi. I imagine that they do. But if they get rid of Gaddafi, which is like getting rid of a cub, and they inherit the mama or the papa, namely us, a lot worse than Gaddafi ever was. You think they're going to sit by quietly and not do anything? I mean, if they came at us with suicide bombers in Iraq, you think they won't do it in Libya too?
Well, sure they will. But you know, the idiocy is that anyone, especially, you know, an American, and it happens all the time in the American press, all these people are somehow or other fighters for democracy, and nobody can prove that. We don't know what they're fighting for. We don't even know who they are. They may be simply opportunists wanting to take advantage of an opportunity to gain some power. That's all. I mean, we don't know anything about who these people are.
Well, they absolutely are opportunists. And I think another thing they have on their mind is all this loot that Gaddafi apparently has got stashed someplace or other, or maybe the stuff we know about that's frozen, and they're hoping to get their hands on some of it. You think Washington and France, and I speak of France and Britain as junior partners, because Washington is definitely in the lead on this. Although, by the way, I have one bit of information in my article for tomorrow picked up from what another site did, that this operation began last year, and the French were the originators of it. And I think one of the reason that France was wanting to do this was Sarkozy in France has got abysmal rock bottom approval ratings because of his austerity plan, just like across Europe, just like here in this country. Except people here haven't awakened yet, but they have in France and they have in Britain. They have in most of the European countries, maybe all of them, but they haven't really awakened here to this god awful austerity. So this Sarkozy has something like a 20% approval rating. That was the worst George Bush ever did. So he's scared that he's not going to get reelected. So, you know, start a war, that you hope, you don't know, but you hope that French people will rally around to get rid of a despot and maybe say, well, you know, maybe this Sarkozy isn't as bad as we thought he was.
Well, yeah, until they get the check.
Yeah.
I heard yesterday, I think it was yesterday, maybe the day before, I've come down with a bit of a cold here and been sitting around doing nothing but sneezing. But I was watching something on television, and somebody said that the United States had launched something like 174 missiles at various targets in Libya at a cost of something like $214 million. Well, it won't take too many days to make that check come through, will it?
Well, you know, again, it's obscene, John. We spend all this money waging these imperial wars, and then we basically say, we're broke. We're broke. We can't do anything to help the states that need money very badly. We can't do anything to help people losing their homes. We can't afford to have a jobs program because we're broke.
Yeah, we are.
But not broke enough. That was one of the reasons for the London protests yesterday.
Yeah, I saw those.
I mean, they really came out. Possibly as many as 500,000 people came out in London, and there was some violence. I don't know whether it was from these people. Sometimes you get official state authorities acting as provocateurs to blame peaceful protesters who simply want justice. I know that happened in Canada, and I think it's happened here in the past, so why not in London, too? You know, smashing windows, doing stuff like that, and I wouldn't be at all surprised if the British authorities would send in the provocateurs to do that. But people are really, really angry that terrible austerity cuts have been announced. Besides others, that were instituted earlier. And but at the drop of a hat, they'll spend millions of dollars a day waging imperial war in Libya, and 500,000 Londoners came out really, really angry about it. So where are they in America? America is spending $100 million a day launching these cruise missiles. Where's the public anger in America?
Hiding.
Too busy watching the basketball tournament, I guess.
Yeah. It's and you know, there's a metaphor for that. You know, we call that the Final Four, except it's the Final Four today.
Oh, indeed.
There's a different Final Four tomorrow.
Oh, well, the Final Four that's raging hell around the world.
Yeah.
Really, the Final One with our allied partners. If you have an evil foursome, U.S., Britain, France, and dare I say Israel?
Well, who?
Well, they would be my foursome.
Yeah.
Well, nobody says anything about what they're doing in occupied Palestine.
Except that, you know, the Israelis are smarter than we are.
I think they are smarter than we are. Look at all the money they're extorting from us.
Not only that, they get other people to fight their wars and pay for them.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they literally got us to fight their Iraq war for them. They were the ones who I think wanted Saddam out more than even we did, and they got us to fight this dirty war, and they want us to fight their dirty Iran war for them, and all their other dirty Middle East wars. And I wrote about a plan that they have had since the 1980s, literally, where they want to be the regional hegemon. They know that we're the global hegemon. But they want to be the regional hegemon, and their plan is very simple. Balkanize all the countries in the region, divide them up in small pieces, dilute their power, so there's only one superpower left standing, this tiny country of Israel, with 6 million or so people. I mean, don't count the, maybe 5 million Jews, and another 1.5 million Israeli Arabs, but don't count them. Because they're not part of the system. They just want to live like ordinary human beings, and enjoy freedoms that they don't get. But Israel wants to be the boss of the region and push America around.
Oh, it's already doing that.
Oh, they are already doing it, absolutely. The power of the Israeli lobby in America, I think, is unmatched by any other. And that really is saying something. And they are hurting themselves, and we are certainly hurting ourselves by this terrible alliance. Oh, we're at the bottom of the hour already. Let's take a break and talk about the nefarious nine.
Okay.
Okay, Joe, we'll come right back after a short break.
You are listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
I'm Elaine Schnupper, host producer of Evolving Ideas, Tuesdays at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, and global on the Internet. Join me each week on the Progressive Radio Network to explore the universe and our relationship to it.
Hello. Check out my show, The Animal Magnet Pet Radio, live every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern on Progressive Radio Network. Or catch it anytime you like by scrolling through the archives. You'll hear me, Deborah Wolf, best-selling author and award-winning radio host, chatting with the best pet experts and animal A-listers in the world about controversial topics like breed bans, the indoor versus outdoor cat debate, and whatever else is hot in the news and on their minds that matters to animals and the people who love them. Plus, we tell pet jokes, we'll give you trivia and smart, quirky facts, recipes, and take-home tricks and tests, homework your pets will love. Email your pet problems to me and we'll solve them on air. So listen to The Animal Magnet on Progressive Radio Network and get your animal fix.
Join us, Bruce and Marianne Curtis, Fridays at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network for Truth and Freedom. We present provocative conversations with the world's most brilliant minds in the areas of holistic health, spiritual wisdom, politics, and a host of other topics. Some of our topics include the latest work in non-invasive therapy on the brain, the truth beneath the global economic meltdown, healing power of the breath, and the sublime truth beyond all religious traditions. In this age of transformation, we need to look beneath the surface appearance of things to see the underlying reality. For material that is always illuminating and often liberating, tune in to Truth and Freedom on the Progressive Radio Network Fridays at 3 p.m.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Article is called The Nefarious Nine and the First Amendment. Oh, it's wonderful how the system works, John. The reigning justices on the Supreme Court, in their supreme wisdom, have decided that the founding fathers, who gave us the Bill of Rights, didn't really mean what they meant. So they straightened it all out in their ruling, and I'll let you explain.
Well, you know, the Supreme Court is an anomalous institution. If it could be fit into the history of the world, I think it would be something like the year 1200 for the Supreme Court. People have said that's the most a respected American institution. It's not even an American institution. It is just one enormous institution pulled out of history centuries ago and put in an important place in the American government. You know, they're always talking about let the decision stand, that and they claim that they do this to make sure that the legal system is consistent. But there's nothing consistent about the American legal system. Each group of justices decides on its own which precedents it's going to rely on which to base its opinions, and they ignore all the others. And then some other another group of nefarious nine comes along and does the same thing with a different set of precedents that they're going to rely on. And they, how do they pick the precedents that they're going to rely on? Well, the ones they like. That's how they do it. And since Madison, laid down in an opinion that it was the Supreme Court's duty to decide what the law is, they have become the de facto rulers of the United States of America and have been the de facto rulers of the United States of America for, well, centuries. It's a scandalous thing. When it happened in the early 1800s, Jefferson was the only one who raised Cain about it, and nobody paid much attention. Jefferson knew that if you gave those people that kind of power, they would become absolute rulers, which is what they are. And when you think about it, ask yourself, what's a court's real function? And one would, I think, one answer would be that it's to resolve disputes among litigants. But our court's decisions don't resolve any disputes. As a matter of fact, they often exacerbate them. The disputes become worse after the court rules rather than better. And the court doesn't care. Why doesn't it care? Because it hasn't taken that view of a court's function. The court doesn't function to resolve disputes in America. The court functions to govern in America. They decide the way they want things to be, and if a lot of the people in the country don't like it, well, that's just too damn bad, because there's nothing you can do about it. We're the court. The way they argue a decision, there's an argument form that used to be used in the Middle Ages by church fathers to prove what was true and what was false, and that was called the method of authority. And they would quote authorities, principally Aristotle in the Bible and church fathers, and say, so-and-so said so-and-so, and so-and-so said so-and-so, therefore so-and-so. And that's the way the court argues. It says, you know, this judge said so-and-so, and this judge said so-and-so, and this judge said so-and-so, and we're going to be consistent with what those guys said, so we're going to say so-and-so. I mean, that's hardly a way to determine what the truth is. Even the church gave that up right after, you know, St. Thomas Aquinas died. But know that's the method of argument used in the courts in America. It's ludicrous in a 21st century that anybody should be arguing that way. But even that's not the worst of it. They claim to be doing what they do by interpretation. And in this little piece on the First Amendment, I have shown that no, they're not. You cannot use the word interpretation to come to the conclusions that they have come to about the First Amendment. You can only do it by substitution, by taking a different concept entirely and replacing the one in the Constitution with the one that they want to use. And I think I've done it quite validly. I haven't seen any way of arguing against what I said in that piece. It's an interesting piece, and maybe some readers will go look at it.
Well, I hope they will, and they can get it on your blog site, John. Just Google John Cozy, K-O-Z-Y, and you'll get the blog, and the article is there. And it's also on Global Research. Anybody can Google Global Research and find it. And, oh, it's marvelous. I mean, you really are a wonderful logic professor emeritus of logic, indeed, John. And you make so much sense. And, of course, we both also know that the court pretty much serves the power interests in the country. So they can very well rule a country, but they rule it along with the administrations and the Congress. And I mean, you can go back so many decisions that were so wrong-headed, if you think of them in terms of what's just and what's unjust. And the modern ones since in the last decade or so, giving the 2000 election to George Bush, where the popular vote was annulled. And even the electoral vote, as it turned out, was annulled. They stopped the recount in Florida, and then later on, when studies were done to complete it, it was found that Al Gore won Florida and won the election, and everybody knew it, but nobody did anything about it. And of course, they waited until 9 months later, thereabouts, before they let that cat out of the bag. And the way they let the cat out, the press, the media, and the way they did it, the few who even mentioned it, was the New York Times, for example. They'll write a long article, and they'll bury this little fact in paragraph 19 that nobody ever gets to. You know, they read the headlines, they might read a couple of paragraphs, and then that's it. That's their attention span. So most people never even knew that Al Gore, by our system, popular vote, electoral vote, U.S. system, won the 2000 election. Al Gore knew it, and he didn't complain about it. And then the court wasn't needed in 2004 when John Kerry won that election, and Kerry knew it and even admitted it to one journalist and author. And then he later retracted his statement, but he was down in black and white or recorded or whatever. And he knew he won, even more so than Al Gore, but he never said anything. A wonderful system we have, and the court goes along with all this. Besides equating money with speech, which you brought on in your article, John, you want to go into that? Money equals speech.
that's one of the things that the court does all the time. It picks a metaphor that it likes, and it turns the metaphor into literal definition, and from that point on, we're in a different world of diction. We're no longer talking about what the Constitution says. We're talking about the metaphor that the court has created to replace the word in the Constitution. And then the speech was the easy one. It's the one that everybody thinks about, but it's really the easy one. When, for instance, where in the Constitution does it say that the First Amendment guarantees political expression? Nowhere. I don't even know what political expression, you know, is restricted to. Was that Iraqi who threw a shoe at President Bush engaged in political expression? I mean, I would say so.
Whether he was right, wrong, or anything else, it certainly was not a First Amendment expression.
And
the one I liked was the bombing of the Oklahoma building.
Oh, yeah.
He could claim he was innocent. He was simply exercising his First Amendment rights.
Yeah, sure. Why not? You know, you know, the Constitution says that the people have a right to petition the Congress for a redress of grievances. But the court has turned that into encourage the Congress to produce some sort of political goal, and that's not in the Constitution anywhere. I mean, when people do that, And I've tried to show, of course, that each of those is a mistake by saying that the freedom of assembly, for instance, has nothing to do with association. But the court makes it out to somehow or other have something to do with association. And I pointed out that I don't know how many hundreds of thousands or whatever assembled in Arlington, Texas to watch the Super Bowl, but they didn't associate. And the American Automobile Association never assembles. You know, but these are the kinds of things that the court does. It mixes up language in this way so as to obfuscate what's being argued, and then it simply, you know, writes whatever conclusion it wants at the end.
I think basically they decide, or at least maybe a group of them get together in some way and decide what they want to do, and then come up with the language to justify it, even if there's no justification at all.
That's well known. They all get together and vote on, you know, up or down on the issue, and then they assign the task of writing the opinion to somebody.
And maybe they'll give a pass just the way they do in Congress to some of them who may need to go the other way to make it look good. I guess there's a fair amount of unanimous decisions, but often you'll get split ones, and quite often maybe 5-4 decisions. That was the Bush v. Gore, 1-5-4. The system was rigged. Bush was going to win, and even the media reports before the final thing was settled, you listen to the right wing media or read the right wing media, and it was case closed. I mean, George Bush is the new president. Why bother going through all this hocus pocus? But then, the Supreme Court acted like a mafia hitman. I mean, basically strong on the system to be the way they wanted it to be.
Well, you know, that's the way it is. And in the previous article, I pointed out that if Madison's statement in early 1800s was true, that is, it's the court's function to decide what the law is, then hell, we're paying the Congress for nothing.
Well, I certainly feel that way, regardless.
Well,
of the
yeah,
role of the
but
court.
I mean, you know, but you know, if that's the court's function, what are we doing with the Congress?
I mean, I'd be very happy to get rid of it.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is that nobody in America points this out. I mean, we must have thousands of political science professors in this country, in both the public and the universities, and nobody points this out. Nobody points out that if the courts have the responsibility of deciding what the law is, then the Congress is irrelevant. You know, I mean, why can't somebody say that? That's what I don't understand. And it's, you know, I didn't make that point about political scientists in this piece, but I made it about professors in law schools. You know, why doesn't anybody in the legal community in this country take these decisions apart like I take them apart once in a while? And why aren't they the law reviews that are published by law schools all over this country full of articles ridiculing the reasoning in these opinions? Nobody wants to do it. You know, the national anthem reads, ends with "Land of the Free and Home of the Brave." It's home of the knave, not brave. I mean, you know, there's nobody in this country with any guts to stand up to the status quo and say, no, damn it to hell, that's wrong.
You know, John, the few good ones who are around, and there are good ones, and I certainly know two of them, and they've been on this program, one in the last couple of months. Marjorie Cohn teaches at law school in San Diego, former head of the National Lawyers Guild, and Francis Boyle, who teaches at the University of Illinois. But, you know, they're shut out of the major media, and they very much stand up for what's right against wrong. And Boyle, I've quoted him a couple of times on this. He's a distinguished graduate of Harvard Law School, And he wrote an article once advising parents not to send their children to Harvard Law School because they have a rogues gallery of professors down there like Alan Dershowitz and others who are less notorious than he is, less well-known. They're probably at least as notorious, but less well-known to most people. Dershowitz may be the best known. But these people are rogues. They support hatefulness, warmongering, racism. What kind of law professors are these? I mean, I wonder what they teach their students. We've got a guy named John.
They taught Mr. Obama constitutional law.
Well, they really did. That's right.
Yeah.
They really did. And another guy who's not at Harvard Law, but a guy who wrote one of the infamous Bush torture memos. But there was more than one. There were a number of them. But he was maybe the chief culprit in writing this stuff. John Yoo, who teaches at University of California Berkeley Law School, I think the Bolt Law School. They have protests outside of his classroom. His classrooms, the last I heard, John, were not announced. They were kept secret to keep the protesters away, but I don't know how you can keep the classroom of a professor secret. I mean, the students all know about it. You mean the word isn't going to get out to others?
Yeah.
but he literally is protested, and the University of California disgraces themselves to have a man like this on their faculty. And I think he teaches constitutional law.
Well, sure. All these guys do. I was part of it, the university system in this country for a long time, and it was obvious to me that it was all a scam, and it didn't even take me a year or two to gather enough experience to figure that out. I mean, you could just look around and you could see that what was going on was just baloney. When it becomes obvious that a person like George Herbert Walker Bush can be granted two earned degrees, one from Harvard and one from Yale, you have to know that this is all a big joke.
Well, it really is, and you know, the fact that he was there meant that they were just to be sure to get him in, get him through, and I don't know that he's entirely stupid, but if his name were George Smith instead of George Bush Jr., whatever, he never would have gotten into either school. But
probably not. Yeah. You know. I'll tell you a story, and I told this to another person on a different interview a week or two ago, but. When I was still teaching, I was visiting a former student. I was having dinner with a former student's house, and they had another couple there, friends of theirs, who had a daughter who was in high school, getting ready to pick a college. And the parents asked me what would be a good school for their daughter. And I hesitated in answering, and they said, well, don't you think college is a good thing for people to go to? And I said, well, sure, it's the only place in America where you can get an elementary education these days. And then I went on to say, I said, look, I said, if your daughter is a good student, she will get a good education anywhere, because the education comes for her going out and getting it, not the education coming to her. And if she's not a good student, she won't get a good education anywhere. Don't waste your money. And that is the truth about the American educational system. Sure, there are some people who go through it and get fantastic educations, but it's because of their efforts. Not because of anything the school provides. The school doesn't provide anything except, you know, facilities and maybe books and maybe some people to talk to. That's all.
you know, I look back at my education, John, and I went to a couple of esteemed schools, and I felt that the one thing that they taught me, more than the material from each of the courses, but the one thing they taught me was how to learn. And I honestly believe that I got my best education on my own, and so much of it in later years when I didn't have to worry about earning a living, and I could do anything I wanted to do, and I did not want to go fishing or what other people who retire do. So I ended up, what I'm involved in now is an all-volunteer initiative for me, and it's wonderful. But I did a lot of reading after I retired, and I just went out on my own, and I did these things, and I became much more aware of the world that I was never taught about back in college. And one example was back at the esteemed Wharton School. We all had to, my major was not in finance, but everybody had to take a money and banking course. And they taught me everything in that course about money and banking, except what they should have taught me, that I went out and learned on my own, and I've written a great deal about it. And I look back now, I've still got my old textbook. It's full of all kinds of garbage formulas that, you know, you memorize or whatever to regurgitate on an exam and then forget about, and they don't mean anything to you unless maybe you want to be a banker. I don't know. Do bankers use formulas?
Well, you know, that's the way I would – when I was talking about the university system a few minutes ago, that's the way I would describe most university professors. I would describe them as textbook professors. That is, they went to school somewhere and read a textbook, okay? And then they, you know, regurgitate that stuff that was in that textbook for the rest of their college careers to students, especially beginning students. I mean, they don't think about any of it. They don't do any research about any of it. They don't criticize any of it. It's just, this was what my textbook said, and now I'm going to teach it to you as your textbook. And they're textbook professors. They really have nothing of their own to profess, which always made me angry. I used to say, you can't be a professor if you don't have anything to profess.
That's lovely.
But you know, but that's what happens. We have textbook professors. The textbook was the worst invention, educational invention, ever produced. In all of my years of teaching in the university, I never had my students buy a textbook.
Hmm.
Never. I would give them reading lists. And I would tell them, you know, I don't care where you get it. You get it at a dime store paperback or on the internet or, you know, if it's in the edition 100 years old, which got old diction in it and no notes, or, it doesn't matter. You know, it's that John Stuart Mill's On Liberty is John Stuart Mill's On Liberty, and I don't give a hoot, you know, how it's bound or who, you know, put it on the market or whatever. Just go read On Liberty. And that's the way students learn, by reading the great books of the world and comparing them to one another.
Oh, indeed so, John, and then maybe discussing it amongst themselves. And
whatever, but, you know, the textbook, I never trusted it. You know, there's a lot of commentaries written in philosophy, like what did Kant say in the Critique of Pure Reason, and a thousand different guys tell you what Kant said in Critique of Pure Reason, and they get a thousand different things. And I said, that's not, you know, I why should I believe any of those guys? How do I know they know what they're talking about?
I wish I had a couple of professors like you, John. I had a couple of good ones, but most of them were big shots who you did well in their courses if you regurgitated what they told you in class. And once you caught on to the system and played the game, you could do very fine. But if you veered off on your own, you might run into trouble. Well, I don't know if that's the way to play the game. And the best one of all I had was in a field that was far from what my main interest was, in natural science, a guy who later won a Nobel Prize in biology or microbiology or whatever, a man named George Wald, a glorious man and a glorious human being. And I'll cram one comment in before the hour ends. I don't remember a single comment I could just about quote from a class back in the 1950s, but I remember one that he made that knocked us all off our chairs at the time in 1953. He said, quote unquote, "There is no such thing as a safe amount of radiation, and any dose of it is an overdose," in 1953.
Well, sure.
And of course, you know, young kids, you know, still in their late teens, you know, I mean, what, we weren't thinking about radiation, but we sure were after that comment that has literally stuck with me to this day. I've never forgotten it. He's gone now. If he was still living, I absolutely would have him on this program.
Okay, and now I want to end with a comment.
Quickly, John, because we're out of time.
And here's the comment. We have become death.
Oh, indeed. John, I thank you so much. I'm going to shoot you an email right now. And, it's a great hour. It pains me to have it in, but we'll get you back. We'll get you back real soon and do it again.
John, okay, Stephen. Good luck.
Oh, many thanks. And, of course, join us Thursdays, 11 a.m. Eastern Time, weekends at 1 p.m., and always make it a regular habit.